Blog Talk Radio.
We are the heirs of that first revolution.
Will a strong and united America still be a force for freedom and prosperity around the world?
America has created the longest peacetime economic expansion in our history.
We are the heirs of that first revolution.
Good common sense and sound judgment of the American people. And their essential love of justice.
Hi, welcome to the Cubs Rewind for September 27th, 2020. I'm your host, David McLaughlin. Rejoining us this week, welcome back, Catherine Smith.
Thank you very much. I'm glad to be back. Greetings.
Yes. And welcome, Tim Shiflett.
Good evening, sir.
All right. We are going to have on the show in about 20 minutes political consultant J.J. Ames. J.J. is working on a lot of different races around the country, and we're going to talk to him in just a little bit. But until then, we pretty much had a debate about what to start with first. I'm just going to tell you the three things. We're only going to get to one and then maybe to part of a second one before our guest. But we have the Supreme Court pick. We don't know what will happen out of that, and that's something we'll discuss. We have the debate, the first debate in the series coming up this Tuesday, and we want to preview it. And then the New York Times drops this article on Donald Trump's tax returns. That dropped. It's so new that not everybody's even prepped for it. So we're going to try to stay away from that a little more, although it may filter in because I think it will affect the debate. And we're going to start with the Supreme Court pick and what have you. Catherine, you didn't get to be with us last week. So first off, I want you to have the space and chance to say your thoughts on the life and work of Ruth Bader Ginsburg. And then from there, we'll conduct the discussion. Catherine?
Well, it's a terrible loss for the country, particularly for progressive citizens who have long admired Ginsburg's leadership on so many things and her incredible work on, especially on women's equality and civil rights and healthcare rights. And so I have to say that this year has been a real body blow with the loss of Congressman Lewis, C.T. Vivian, Joseph Lowry, and then Ruth Bader Ginsburg, along with 200,000 Americans who lost to COVID. So it's been a real sad week for me, honestly. But like Congressman Lewis and like Ruth Bader Ginsburg inspired us, we have to just keep working and live out their legacy. So I'm ready to get back to work now that I've had a chance to reflect. So thank you for the space to mention it.
Yes. Well, and obviously this process has moved so fast. That's what we talked about last week. We usually would take a little more time with this, but it pushed into politics immediately, and it kept pushing. Late in the week, we kind of had heard that it would probably be Amy Coney Barrett. And then people started telling more about her. The choice was finally made yesterday, the announcement, I should say. And we've learned more and more about her. Tim, tell us about what you think about the process thus far, and then any thoughts on what you've heard about her record or projection to this point.
Well, the process is expedited's not even a strong enough word for this. I mean, Ruth Bader Ginsburg's lying in state while the president's already naming her her replacement, and Lindsey Graham is already talking about starting up hearings in his committee. And he's even set a date for her to be confirmed by the Senate in late October, which would just be lightning fast, the fastest that has ever been done. And, you know, there's not really anything anybody can do to stop it. And there we are. This is going to alter the direction, of course, of the court for years. And, you know, the comparisons to what everybody said in 2016 and as to compared to what they're saying now is stunning to
yeah.
To to be short about it. And, you know, her politics and, you know, the way she has conducted herself in the Court of Appeals, I believe the 7th District's where she's at for 3 years, you know, is all a matter of the public record. So I don't think we're going to be getting any surprises, guys, unless we get our first one on November the 10th, the day that the court will hear the Trump administration's arguments for ending the Affordable Care Act.
Yes. Well, Catherine, Tim kind of brought us into the, you know, the political issues. There's so many things that they do polling on and they show where the American people are. And then we hear about, you know, the direction that she and maybe a few others want to take the court in that's against that opinion. Tim alluded to it. The ACA is well above water. It's close to 20% more popular, something like a 54, 56% approval, 34 maybe disapproval, somewhere in that vicinity. On the polling I've seen, you have Roe v. Wade, which when you ask about Roe v. Wade, it's pretty clear that people want that landmark decision to stand. You know, there's a lot of other ones. What do you think people that want to try to maybe not stop but slow this process down, what's maybe the best tactical case law or issue to go on, to focus on?
Boy, I don't know how they – you know, I don't know all the as Nancy Pelosi said, all the quivers they have in their – or all the arrows they have in their quiver. But it doesn't look to me like there's – I mean, as things stand right now, it seems, you know, one of the things they said was that is calendaring the interviews and just saying, well, that the senators are too busy. They have a previous appointment, so they can't, you know, they can't fit in all the appointments. That sounds like an unlikely, unlikely successful scenario. So I don't know all the tricks that they have up their sleeves, but it doesn't look to me like I'm not very optimistic about stopping the process unless there's a hurricane or, you know, a pandemic. you know, but I think what we have to – I mean, I think it's important for – Democrat for anyone who opposes this appointment to be outspoken about it and make sure their senators know that. But the chance of stopping it seems unlikely to me. And I agree that seems remote.
Yeah. And as far as the scheduling, I hear what you're saying, and it seems like that, you know, I won't say could work, but could be a factor if everybody was going to meet with her. But my understanding is it's just the senators, and I don't know if it's just all senators or just the judiciary members, but so many of them on the Democratic side have said this process is not legitimate, therefore I'm not going to meet with her. I know Chuck Schumer and Kirsten Gillibrand have said they won't. I think Dick Durbin said he would. He would be willing to have a socially distanced conversation with her. If they, I don't know, like if they said, okay, we're willing to meet with her, and then they slow played the process and met with her one a day for the next, you know, 40 some odd days, could they stretch it out theoretically? But I think at that point the Republicans would ignore it anyway. But if they're saying we don't want to meet because it's not a legitimate process, that takes that quiver away, if you will, right, Catherine?
Yeah, I didn't hear that. I heard the opposite. But I don't think it matters anyway. If the Republicans say, well, you're not going to meet with her, we're going to vote anyway. I mean, I just feel like the Democratic senators don't really have many, there's not very many possibilities to stop it. But I don't know if they have some, you know, they may have some, bureaucratic or administrative or some kind of strategy that we don't know about, because they haven't been as forthcoming about it. But it just doesn't seem likely that we'll be able to stop them. And I feel like we need to be honest about that.
Yes, the Senate is important, and we just don't have control. And usually, if there's procedural things you can do, constitutional and procedural scholars know about it even before the senators and get on CNN and MSNBC and tell it. Tim, let's kind of get into the record some. She's apparently belongs to an organization that they keep talking about her Catholicism, but this organization sounds nothing like any Catholicism I know, where women take that passage of the Bible, so, you know, women submit or wives submit to your husbands and everything so literally. It seems like if she's a Supreme Court justice that has to make decisions, then if she believes in this group that you have to submit in everything, she'd have to call her husband up on every decision, theoretically, wouldn't she?
The small group of people, I understand they got 1,700 members nationwide, although they've got a lot of money and they do things like sponsor schools and stuff like that. The group is called People of Praise. They are some of the most fundamental of the Catholics. Most of this group is Catholic, although, you know, some Protestants are allowed into the group too. And they just basically take every word of the Bible literally, like a fundamentalist would. And yes, I do suppose that, you know, the part about, you know, wives submitting themselves to their husbands, that they take that one to heart as well, that if a woman is going to do something, that she would, you know, perhaps need to check with her husband to make sure it's okay and that sort of thing. I don't know how it's played out in some of the rulings that she's had, because I'm looking here at some of her rulings, and there's some interesting reading material here, let me tell you. That religious thing has come to the forefront with her, and a lot of her defenders have responded by saying, how dare you attack this woman's religion, blah, blah, blah. I don't guess anybody's attacking it, but obviously there are questions about that, as there are about everything else, especially if it's going to affect the way she conducts herself on the bench.
Well, I mean, a lot of conservatives, you know, point to anybody that's Muslim and says that they want to support Sharia law. Well, I mean,
we're dealing with people,
I think that would be a legitimate issue.
Sorry, we're dealing with people that have two sets of rules, one for them and one for us.
Yeah, if somebody wanted to, instill a strict Muslim social code, then that would be an issue that you would discuss, just like this would be. Catherine, theoretically, I mean, if this lady believes all of these things, shouldn't her husband, Barrett, be the one being nominated for the Supreme Court and not her, since she has to call him up on every decision she makes?
Well, there's that, but there's another troubling thing about this People of Praise. They have each person is assigned, I guess, a guide or a advisor who within the group who is supposed to guide them on all important decisions. I think they're called an advisor.
I read on that. It's every man and every single woman, because once you're married, your guide is your husband, so that goes back to husband Barrett.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
I didn't realize that.
Yeah. So
but
it goes back to husband Barrett.
But,
so.
But I know there have been, I've heard rumors. I don't know. I did not read this in a newspaper, but I heard it from someone who like went to law school with her, that there is also an advisor that she refers to on certain things. So in any event, I just think that this organization plays a very large role in her life. And for that reason, I think it deserves some consideration in this discussion. I mean, anytime someone is that involved in an organ, I think it's legitimate to say, well, what is the role of this group and their teachings in your, what could the role be in your judicial decisions? I think that's a perfectly legitimate question.
Yeah. I mean, the Republicans at their convention, Lou Holtz called Joe Biden a Catholic in name only. So they've attacked his religion. So
right.
They've already crossed that as well.
But again, two sets of rules. Remember.
That's right.
Right.
Oh, yes. Well, let's get into some more. Apparently in some judicial writings, she's not, I mean, people talk about her reversing Roe v. Wade, but she's so staunch in her anti-reproductive rights beliefs, she's against condoms and IUDs and just basic before conception, prevention methods. That was decided back in the Roosevelt administration, a lot of these questions. Catherine, I'll let you ask first. How will this play with the American public?
Well, you know, it's what is it like about, I think the last poll I saw was 65% of Americans believe that Roe v. Wade should not be overturned, that abortion should be an option for all Americans, all those who can be pregnant.
But that's Roe v. Wade and abortion, which we know, you know, the numbers are one thing.
Well, no,
but
let,
condoms
let me,
and
let me
IUDs,
finish.
Yeah.
Let me finish.
Okay.
That and contraception is, while there it's been a point of a lot of contention over the years, it is now a pretty much standard understanding that contraception should be available. And really should be available under health insurance for nominal or no charge. I mean, it's part of almost every woman and every family's decision on how they build their family. So I think that's really out there in terms of, you know, but it doesn't really, like, we can talk about all these things, but we don't get to vote on this Supreme Court justice. And I don't think the Senate, you know, the Senate is almost all old white men, and they don't really have, either they don't care or they don't understand how important this is. To American women, especially.
Well,
so,
I just think it makes you look out of step.
We can say all we want, but they're not gonna.
Yeah.
They're not gonna listen.
Yeah,
I think this.
It just makes you look out of step, and that's part of the framing. Well, right now, I want to welcome in our guest for the first time to the Kudzu Vine. Welcome, JJ Ames. Welcome, JJ.
Hey, Devin, how you doing?
Doing good. Well, JJ, go ahead, first time being on the show. Tell our listeners a little bit about your bio and political background.
Sure. I'm happy to do that. My political background started, I guess, the first day that I started law school about 1,000 years ago. I immediately took a job. I went to law school in Kansas, and I took a job working for the then Kansas State Democratic chairman, a guy named Bob Tilton, now deceased. And Bob put me to work on having absolutely nothing to do with the law and everything to do with politics. So my first assignment was to work on the campaign of Kansas Congresswoman at that time, Martha Keys. I worked on Congresswoman Keys' first campaign, and then went to work for Congresswoman Keys for about 3 years, and kind of got the bug, you know. And after that, I ended up as a labor policy advisor on the national presidential campaign of then Nebraska Senator Bob Kerry, and when in 1992, and when Senator Kerry dropped out, and then transferred over to the campaign of California Governor Jerry Brown. Worked with Jerry Brown for the full year that he was campaigning, all the way up through the 1992 convention. And for Governor Brown, I was his labor policy advisor, labor liaison, and then I also became his speechwriter. And speechwriting and strategic communications really excited me quite a little bit. So that took me down the road of becoming a general consultant. So since 1996, I've been involved in campaigns from county sheriff to lieutenant governor in two states, and congressional campaigns across the country. So we've done probably 50, 60 campaigns at this point. And I took a little bit of time off in 2015 to go back to school at George Washington University and get a master's degree in political management, where my focus was on data analytics and micro-targeting. So right now I'm working on two congressional campaigns and a presidential campaign.
Yes, and going to University of Illinois Springfield as well.
Absolutely, with two semesters or semester and a half to go, and then on to hopefully Arizona, back to Arizona State to work on the PhD.
Yeah, been all over.
Yeah.
Well, JJ, and also in there, just as you were talking about booking the show, Georgia, since maybe a plurality of our listeners maybe in Georgia. Tell us a little bit about your work in Georgia as well.
My political work in Georgia, I was involved in politics in Georgia from probably 2008 to about 2007 to about 2012. I actually was a bundler for President Obama in 2008 and was heavily involved in President Obama's Georgia campaign in 2008. Which was an interesting situation, because right now the Biden campaign has Georgia as a swing state. I'm one of the few that I don't know that I'm quite buying that yet, because I remember 2008 when the Obama campaign came in and said, we're going to be competitive here. We're going to dump a ton of money in here. The president's going to come down once, maybe twice, who knows, three times maybe. And on about September the 5th, they called me and said, we're closing all the offices in Georgia. We're taking the money somewhere else. So, I was heavily involved in trying to organize areas of Georgia that were there, but really were functionally ineffective at the time. And so we spent a lot of effort on the ground and in the grassroots side of things.
Yes, well, that's interesting to know too. Well, I wanted to ask you about a question. Is I was alluding to, you and I are in a class together at Zoom wise, because one of us are in Illinois, and we were discussing this open Supreme Court seat, and something that I had not heard anywhere else, and I wanted to expand on it. Now, obviously, people know that Roe v. Wade may be overturned, the ACA may be overturned, other things, but you mentioned gay marriage. Freedom.
I'm sorry, you cut out a minute for a second, Dave.
Yeah, you're cutting out, Dave.
Uncision and the
still cutting out.
It's kind of been made. Why did you think that may be at risk if Amy Coney Barrett or someone like her were to be on the Supreme Court?
Now, I missed the whole first part of the question, so I hope you can give that back
cut
to me
out.
Again.
I'm sorry, I must have cut out. I apologize.
Badly.
Talking about, I'm somebody's using a blower and I'm having to move away from that to try to get better sound in the background. I like to do like I did the Zoom class. Let me try again. Other day on the show, you may, or on the, our class, you mentioned that if someone like Amy Coney Barrett were to be put on the Supreme Court, that the gay marriage may be at risk, and that's something that's not, I think, been mentioned as much. Why do you think that may be the case?
Well, you know, gay marriage is now the law of the land by virtue of the Supreme Court, the 5-4 Supreme Court decision. But if that were to, and some states and prior to that had gone ahead and legislatively or in some other form or fashion acknowledged gay marriage. But still, the only reason why gay marriage is lawful from coast to coast is because of Justice Anthony Kennedy. In the 5-4 decision. So if there's a 6-3 majority, and even assuming that Justice Roberts would move over and become the new Justice Kennedy, a swing vote in a 6-3 is still a 5-4. So it's if there were another case to come up, for example, if a state that had not if a state like Indiana, for example, that had at one point outlawed gay marriage and declared as a state that marriage was between a man and a woman. If that case were to come back up to the Supreme Court, it would have probably a better chance than overturning Roe, because in Roe you've got a 50-year precedent, and in their 40-plus-year precedent, and in the gay marriage situation you really only have a decade-long precedent or less. And both Amy Coney Barrett, when she was being confirmed as a judge of the appellate court, she refused to acknowledge that the precedent was anything that the Supreme Court justices should pay attention to. And so, she went so far as to say in her testimony that Brown versus Board of Education may not have been decided properly. So who knows how far Amy Coney Barrett would take the court back? And when you have people like Clarence Thomas, like Alito, and like Kavanaugh and Gorsuch on the court. I mean, I see this as the ultimate slippery slope that Republicans keep talking about, a slippery slope into socialism. This is a slippery slope into fascism from a judicial perspective, very, very quite easily.
Yes, well, let me just kind of expand on that. That seems like it's something that's been decided, and the American people are at a different place than they were even, say, 10 years ago, certainly 20 years ago. What would that do to the standing of the Republicans, or would that make this issue not as settled as it is now?
Well, it certainly could unsettle what the rest of us are presuming is a settled issue. And you know, the odd thing about the Republicans right now is you know, they're really, as we've talked about in various classes, there really is no Republican Party today. There are actually two, maybe even three Republican parties, which is the reason why they can't ever get consensus among themselves on anything. But the dominant the sect within those three parties right now is still the Trump section, and all you have to do is point to Lindsey Graham to show that. So, I mean, if the Republican Party just doesn't seem to care what the people think, as long as they can win a primary in a safe, secure district and get reelected, that's really all they care about. And that's a sad state of affairs, but it's all part and parcel of what's taken this country to a point where, you know, we're one triggering event away from the start of Civil War 2.0, and those who are willing to acknowledge that are scared, and I'm one of them.
Yes, well, I'm going to go ahead and pass this over to Catherine, and then she'll pass it over to Tim. Catherine?
Hey, thanks for being on with us tonight. We really appreciate it.
Hey, thanks, Catherine.
I'm actually going to ask you another question about the court, now that I know that you're a labor expert, because that's the other thing that Amy Coney Barrett doesn't have a very good record on, is labor and unions. And sure, what are your concerns around that?
Well, I think that it's part and parcel of her overall judicial philosophy. I mean, you have to begin from the original premise that she clerked for Antonin Scalia. And Antonin Scalia was, again, three counties to the right of Mussolini in that case. So, in fact, the funny thing about Antonin Scalia is that the law school at George Mason University was renamed after his passing as the Antonin Scalia School of Law, and which the professors were so upset there that they now will only refer to it as AFLAW for Antonin Scalia School of Law. So the but the point about Amy Coney Barrett and unions is that her opinion on unions and her record with organized labor is really just a reflection of her overall judicial philosophy, which is one of essentially we got ours and the rest of you can go to hell, and it doesn't matter whether that's from a labor perspective or from a gay rights perspective or from an abortion rights perspective. It's really just a philosophy of it's an elitist entitled philosophy that trickles down into any aspect of any case that would come before the court.
Very, very, very depressing to hear you say that, but I agree. On to other things. I wonder what you think about if, God forbid, President Trump were reelected, what do you think that would mean in California? How do you think what would the response be there? It's such a large state with such a large economy. Do you think there would be backlash against that? Like,
I had this conversation with the people that are running the CalExit movement, and I can tell you that California is today the fourth and a half, almost the fourth largest economy in the world, and the best example in terms of answer I can give you in terms of answering your question is this: in the 2016 election, 28.5 million Californians voted the presidential election. Now they didn't all vote for the same person, but if they did, if all 28.5 million Californians voted for the same person, it wouldn't have changed the outcome of the election. So we've reached a point where the president of the United States can be elected and lose the popular vote by 20 million votes and still become the president of the United States. So if you're a Californian, you have to ask yourself, it is entirely possible that you will never, given the Electoral College, it's entirely possible that you will never again cast a vote for a person who was elected to be the president of the United States. So how long should the fourth largest economy in the world go to be involved in a situation where they subsidize some aspect of all 49 other states with the amount of tax revenue that's generated and the size of the GDP in California, and yet never have an influence on the election of another president? So, I mean, how long should it be before the fourth and a half largest economy takes in Oregon and Washington and becomes the fourth largest economy and forms whatever we want to call the nation that would be California, Washington, and Oregon, assuming Hawaii would join in. But, you know, that's where we are right now. You have a situation where, you know, again, Californians have two choices. One is to say, we are going to be, based on our contribution to the overall makeup of the United States of America, if we're going to stay here, we need to have some assurances that you're not simply taking from us, redistributing to the rest, and then asking us to simply bend over the table again 4 years from now and have the solid states of the South reelect Donald Trump. You know, it's just not. I think the backlash would be enormous in answer to your question. It's already there. The CalExit referendum is on the 2020 ballot. It won't win, of course, and at this point, but it's certainly getting some exposure. And the referendum would permit the California General Assembly to amend the state's constitution to then permit secession. And I think if you re-elect Donald Trump in come 2022, what won't pass this time may pass the next time.
Wow. That's really interesting. Mm. Thank you. So my next question is more general. Since you've been doing this for a long time, Tim and I can totally relate. We've both been around for a long time too. how do you think can't, I mean, David's been around for a long time too, but Tim and I are older. How do you think campaigning, like, what are the major differences in campaigning now and in, like, the mid-90s? How has, you know, the early vote, I'm especially interested in early voting. I think that this has been a big change, that it's taken a long time, at least in my purview, a long time for campaigns to, and they still aren't quite up to speed, I think, to recognize that people are voting so much earlier that they can't really wait until those last 10 days like they have in the past. And social media and all these other things. What do you think the major changes are, and how are we doing, both as Democrats and in general as campaigning goes, in answering and reflecting those changes?
Well, early voting is a huge change, and it's actually becoming a much bigger circumstance than even it might have earlier been imagined. I mean, you know, as more and more states go to earlier and earlier voting, and I say that with one caveat, as more and more states that tend to be a little bit more progressive in nature go to more and more earlier voting, you're also seeing some of the more Republican-dominated states attempt to restrict early vote or even eliminate early voting. So I think there's this, it's all part, again, of this tendency on the part of Democrats to believe that that when more people vote, Democrats win, and Republicans believing when more people vote, Democrats win. So I you know, in terms of the question about the differences between earlier days and today, certainly the internet has been an enormous change. Early voting has been a big change. You're exactly correct to say that many campaigns, by the time they figure out that their get out the vote drive has become less important than their micro targeting efforts, they've lost the race. And typically going back into the late 80s, early 90s, you know, a campaign would save 40% of its budget for the last 3 weeks of the campaign. And now if you save 40% of your budget for the last 3 weeks of the campaign, you've lost before you start. So early voting is one aspect. The internet is another aspect. The availability of big data to campaigns that wasn't necessarily available in the late 80s and early 90s, which allows for micro targeting and for, you know, concentrated having ads and solicitations and what have you. The proliferation of internet fundraising, it all goes hand in hand. That's the reason why, after 25 years in the business, I went back to school because data analytics. When in my first campaign, if I had started to talk about data analytics, they'd have put me in a rubber room with a funny jacket on me, you know, because it just didn't exist. And whereas now it's an enormous part. And
it was city directories and you know, index cards.
Exactly. If you were unless you were running a national campaign, you were lucky you got anything other than a reverse phone directory from your local Bell telephone. That's right. The proliferation of the big data is really very, very important today too.
I'm going to send it off to Tim. Tim.
Good evening, sir. Thank you for being with us tonight.
Hey, no problem, Tim.
Obviously, we are in a wild and crazy year for campaigns or about anything else. So naturally, what do I want to talk about? Well, the state where you cut your teeth, the state of Kansas. And I'm going to give away my age right off the bat, because I actually remember the last time that a Democratic candidate for president won Kansas, and that was Lyndon Johnson. But now, this very day, 538, I'll give them credit, their compilation polling shows
that if the election were held today, that Biden would probably only lose Kansas by, between 8 and 9 points. How is it possible in ruby red Kansas that we are seriously talking about the Democratic candidate for president possibly getting as much as 45% of the vote there?
Well, you have a Democratic governor, which always helps a little bit. You've got some good Democratic congressional candidates. You've got a good Democratic Senate candidate. You've got a party that's been rejuvenated and energized. There's a lot of outside money that's coming into Kansas for the local races at this stage, the congressional races at this stage of the game, and there's still, to a certain extent, I think there's still a Brownback backlash right now.
Uh-huh.
Sam Brownback really damn near bankrupted Kansas, and in the process did bankrupt a number of school districts, and there's still a number of Kansans that are smarting from that. Also, the demographic makeup of Kansas has moderately changed over the course of the last 20 years. There's a substantially larger Hispanic influence in Kansas than there ever was. And oddly enough, I don't understand this for the life of me, more young Kansans are staying in Kansas. With the younger people, there's a strong young vote, there's a stronger Hispanic vote, there's a stronger Democratic influence in the politics of the state, even though it will be a really cold day down under if the Democratic Party ever took control of the Kansas State House. But I think there are just a number of factors that come into play, and it's almost like this perfect storm situation. And we also have Chris Kobach to thank for that, by the way, too. So I might add that.
Mm-hmm.
Chris turned a lot of Republicans into Democrats in Kansas over the last 6 or 7 years, and as long as he continues to run for everything from dog catcher to president, I think that will probably continue.
Okay, now if I'm looking at a map of Kansas, you mentioned growing Hispanic population and the growth of young people staying at home. Am I looking way over at the eastern side of Kansas toward the Kansas City area to find that population, or are they scattered out somewhere else?
I would say you're correct to say that there's a cluster in the Kansas City area. There's also a cluster up in the northeast corner up in the Leavenworth area. And there's also a cluster in the Wichita area as well, down in Central County.
Wichita, huh? Oh,
yeah.
That's interesting. Okay, now you mentioned your Senate candidate, of course, running for the open seat out there, Barbara Bowyer. And she is the Democratic nominee. On Friday, President Obama endorsed several candidates for various offices in Kansas, but Bowyer was not among them. Any idea why that was?
Well, my suspicion is that she is a converted Republican and a very recent converted Republican, and I think that probably has more to do with it than anything else.
Uh huh.
If the race were deemed to be closer than I believe it's going to be, he may have stepped in. But if you're a former president, you don't like to endorse somebody that in advance is going to get the hell beat out of them. And I don't know that it's going to be that bad.
Uh-huh.
I don't know that it's going to be that bad for Barbara. But I think when you combine the fact that she's not a convert 20 years ago, she's a convert 20 months ago. And at this point, I think that probably has more to do with it than anything else.
Okay. Now, of course, one of his endorsements came to the one incumbent Democratic U.S. House member, Sharice Davids, who was one of those folks who came from out of nowhere and shocked the world in the 3rd District in 2018 when we took over the House. And she defeated a four-term congressman. Will she hold this year?
I think so, because I think that the general tendency in 2020 is going to be for large turnout just about everywhere. And I think that in a case of Sharice Davis. I think that she's gotten some really good exposure since her election locally, and I think that she'll produce her people will get out, and I think she will be reelected. We're hoping also to I'm working the Kansas 2 race right now with Michelle uh-huh. DeLisa, and I'm uh-huh. hoping that. I'm hoping that we can find lightning in a bottle there. I worked the Paul Davis race in the same district in 2018, and we were on target. We felt as though we had exceptional out of state money that came in, and we were in that race until a couple of weeks before the election, when Steve Watkins' father created a super PAC with about $800,000 in it. He's now under investigation by the FEC for the manner in which that PAC was created. And Steve Watkins, as you know, himself not running for reelection, lost his primary election bid for reelection because he was indicted 2 weeks before the primary for voter fraud. So we lost to a voter fraud whose father's under investigation, and now we hope to go back in and turn that seat this time. So.
All right. Now, I got one more question about the average Kansan voter. And I want to compare them to a couple of neighborhood states, Oklahoma to your south and Missouri to your east. Is the average Kansas voter more like the voters in Missouri or Oklahoma right now?
Wow, that's really an interesting question from this perspective, Tim. Oklahoma is just a Oklahoma is Oklahoma. Put it that way. I have to get through Oklahoma from time to time. I just try to get through there real fast. That's the way it is. But you can find places in Oklahoma where you can turn a corner and you're in 1952, and Missouri is maybe a little bit less like that, but I think that the difference in Missouri is that you in Missouri you have such an over in Oklahoma you've got the cowboy mentality, and uh-huh. in Missouri primarily you've got the Southern Baptist mentality. I mean, you get into Southwest Missouri, you get into Southeast Missouri. And it used to be in New York City, the expression is there's a Starbucks on every corner, and on some corners there's four. In those sections of Missouri, there's a church on every corner, and some corners there's four. So, I mean, there's the influence. I don't know how Claire McCaskill ever became a U.S. senator, because it's in Missouri much, much harder to take progressive social positions and have any kind of a national career, but that's even a local career at that point. I mean, I find Missouri to be significantly more conservative in many ways than Oklahoma, because Oklahoma is more wild, wild west, and that's kind of there's an element of conservatism there and Second Amendment influence, but there's also this kind of laissez-faire, kind of free and easy way that you find it in the Wild Wild West that you don't necessarily find in the Southern Baptist, more Southern Baptist oriented state of Missouri. And in Kansas, I think Kansas has taken some of Oklahoma and some of Missouri, and then said, well, there's good parts there and there's good parts there. Now we're going to try to use this as a ball of clay and make something better out of it. So Kansas is rapidly becoming more progressive than either of its neighboring states.
Oh, excellent analysis. I appreciate it. And with that, I am going to send it back to David. David?
Yes. Well, JJ, we thank you for being on the show. Hey, before you leave, Tim and Catherine aren't going to believe this, but on our class, our Zoom calls every week where we talk about politics, there's in the mid-20s, about 25, 27 people in the class. Would you say that I am one of the one or two most progressive liberal people on the Zoom call every week?
Oh, I would think, in fact, if I didn't know you, David, and somebody was just asking me this, independently, I'd say you're about three counties to the left of Bernie Sanders.
it's a wild Zoom call. Sometimes I'm the moderate on the show at times. So it's just my midweek is different than my weekend, if you will. Yes.
Well,
JJ, thanks for that.
I used to advertise myself as three counties left of Bernie Sanders until I met you, David. Now you're just a little bit farther out there than I am. So
I guess I'm just vocal. That one fellow, I won't mention his name. He got to me last week. Well, JJ, if somebody wanted to read your political writings or follow your tweets or anything on social media, if you want to share it, feel free now.
Well, yeah, I'm going to be completely candid. Because I work with a number of national politicians whose careers could be impacted by my tweets, I only tweet under pseudonyms.
Good deal.
I don't use Facebook because I want my candidates, my clients, I want my candidates to be elected based upon their merits, not tossed out of office because of my stupidity. So I do tend to. To have rather strong opinions on Twitter, but fortunately, I'm the only one who knows where they're coming from. So if anybody ever did want to get in touch with me, in any way, years ago, I did do a political blog, which I've gotten away from now that I just don't have time for it. But if anybody wanted to get in touch with me, my email is real easy. It's my university email. It's hames3@uis.edu. And I'm always happy to answer questions. I am the head of a boutique consulting agency, which is my company's name is the James Gang. And that's for J. Ames. So it's with the James Gang. And it's James Gang Strategies. And so if anybody wants to get in touch for any reason whatsoever, I'm always happy to oblige. And I respond to most things that come in. And again, the email is hames3@uis.edu.
Yes, sir. Well, thanks again, JJ, for coming on.
Hey, you guys
so
have
much.
A great night. Yep. Take
you
care.
Thank you, sir.
You.
Hey, and get out and vote, and if you have to vote twice, Donald Trump says it's okay to vote twice, so go ahead. you guys are a great
Thanks
night
again.
Now.
Thank
care.
You.
All right. Yes, J.J. Ames, political consultant, really all over the country, focused a little bit in the central of the country right now while we spent so much time with Kansas this week, but that is an intriguing state. But in our last roughly 10 minutes. Let's get back to Georgia. This U.S. Senate special election is so intriguing. 21 candidates for starters, and then so many wrinkles in the way it was structured. I guess this past week, Kelly Loeffler made news saying that she's to the right of Attila the Hun, and then Doug against her. I guess she was asking for that. But the polling shows that really Doug Collins is not making much progress, is he, Catherine?
No, he's not. He's not. He must not have very much money because he's not on TV all that much.
Yeah. No, not to do a Till of the Hun comparison commercials. Tim, what was your thought when you saw the Till of the Hun ad that Kelly Loeffler put together?
You honestly, I thought it was one of the worst U.S. Senate ads that I had ever seen in my life. It's more like some kind of parody ad that some candidate running for some local office that just wants to be noticed by the voters would make that nobody would take seriously, but everyone would remember the ad. And clap good old Joe on the back down at the hardware store who did it and say, "That's great. I'm going to vote for you, buddy." I do not know what the ad people were thinking on this one. That was really a sad ad. It was not a good ad at all.
I'd love to ask about that, Fred.
The first time I saw it, I thought it was negative ad against her.
yeah.
Right? I mean, I thought it was like and then I was really quite confused by it at first. I had to like wait till it came back on and to see it again, and then of course there was all the word about it. But yeah, I thought it was terrible.
Yeah, I wonder at what point do Republicans see an ad like this and go, wait, do we want to be the right of Attila the Hun? You know, it's some self-reflection. Is that a good thing to be that far right?
Dude, they had a guy set it. They had a guy sitting there. What was he doing?
Yeah. He was supposed to be Attila the Hun.
Please. No, please. No. Just no.
Yeah, and I would like to ask if Fred Davis comes back on the show sometime soon, what does he think about that? I think he'd be an interesting perspective on that actual ad. Well, that's not all to this race. We see that Kelly Loeffler's in the mid to low 20s. Doug Collins is in the low 20s. Raphael Warnock is in the low 20s. Sometimes he'll be ahead of Doug Collins. Sometimes he'll be even with Doug Collins. Maybe he's still even a poll or two behind Doug Collins. And as we know, these polls, they're probably asking about five or six candidates on the call. They're not reading that list of 21 people in which Raphael Warnock appears as candidate 20 in that list. Catherine, how concerned are you that this runoff could be between Kelly Loeffler and Doug Collins?
I was very concerned about that, but I had a conversation with a friend of mine who lives in New Orleans. You know, Louisiana has these jungle primaries all the time now. And my friend was surprised to say that she used to be concerned about this too, but that in almost every case, the primaries end up, the runoff ends up being between a Democrat and a Republican. That it just is the way it works. So she was not as concerned about it. She used to live in Georgia as I am. So I'm a little less concerned now, but it's definitely a concern, especially with so many, all these other candidates. You know, you're likely going to have some people who vote for, you know, somebody's going to vote for all of them, right? Their mother, their, you know, family and all that, their friends are going to vote for their friends, likely. And I'm concerned about it, but less than I was a week ago.
Catherine, apologize for laughing. When you said all of them, I could picture someone checking all 21 names. They're going to vote
for all of them.
And they're about to be. But I know what you mean. But I will say this. Remember a few years, I guess it was 2 years ago, was it Cindy Zeldin? She was like the people in the know's choice for insurance commissioner, and she didn't win the primary. And nobody had ever heard of won the nomination, because here's the thing: all the people in the know are not all the people. And I'm looking at these names, and some of these names, you know, they just look like average folks. I really need to pull up Political Wire. But I could see somebody, there's one, I believe she was Lithonia Mayor. Her last name's a J, I want to say. I really should have pulled all this up ahead of time. But I could see 10, 7, 4% of the people just stopping there and going, that sounds like a credible Democratic candidate, and her getting some outsized portion. I think it's going to be more of that than it is, say, Matthew Lieberman getting more vote total than people think that he would normally get. Tim, what's your take?
Tim?
Okay, he's on the board. Let's refresh the board. Well, and Catherine, as we wait for Tim to jump on in, and I'm going to make sure something didn't cap on the muting, the candidate I'm talking about is Deborah Jackson. There's a Jamisa James, also a Democrat, then a Tamara Johnson Shealy, then Matt Lieberman, then Joy Felicia Slade. We've got a bunch of Democrats in a row alphabetically. I guess Slade would actually come a lot later. Well, maybe not in this particular one. I'm not sure what's going on with Tim and the board. Tim, I apologize to you if you can hear us and we can't hear you. But, you know, I could see these candidates each getting, say, 5% of the vote and that may be all that's needed to end up having a Collins-Loeffler runoff. What do you think, Catherine?
Well, you could say the same thing about the Republicans, too.
Well, there's not as many. I mean, there are some. There's that Al Bartel who runs, you know, every time there's an election.
I thought there were about seven Republicans.
Yeah, there's Wayne Johnson. There's a lady, Kia something. She's got an interesting little deal going on her website. I'm trying to find her. Candace Taylor, and it's KISS, and she kind of plays into the KISS thing. It's kind of odd that someone would play it up. The fact that their name has the word KISS in it and they're a, you know, political candidate, but just some strange stuff. So, I mean, and theoretically, yes, they could also get an outsized vote share than what they get. But I just kind of think the Republicans may go into this a little more organized, knowing that it's a binary choice for the most part between those two.
That could be true. I guess the ones I'm worried about are Carver and Lieberman, because I think they have the – of name recognition, they probably have the most, besides Warnock. But
that's the thing. I actually like Ed Tarver. I think Ed Tarver is a very, very qualified candidate, but you know, I don't know that anybody besides the insiders know him either, and he's going to be way deep down there with Raphael Warnock anyway. Let me switch over to Tim. I figured out something going on with the board. I had to get on like three computers, but I don't think it was my computer's fault. It was something else. Tim, back with us.
Yeah, I never left.
Okay.
Actually, I don't know.
I don't
what
know
was
what
happening.
Happened. Well, it was something was screwy, and I got you back on. And now, give us your take on the Democratic side of this slate. You probably heard a lot of what we were saying then.
Yeah, I heard it all. As a matter of fact, what we got eight Democrats, and they are splitting the vote. I'm concerned about it a little bit, but I do believe that Warnock has probably been gaining at the expense of Lieberman, who has lost had about a 3-point erosion lately, down to around 11%. The endorsement by President Obama has to help Warnock immensely in this race. It really gets him on the map. People are looking at him now. The thing is, as of yesterday, 22,000 people had already voted. And you just got to wonder who they have voted for, if most of them are Democrats. Is it like you said, David, and the alphabetical thing is going to be just this terrible problem? Are eight Democrats splitting the vote a little bit too much, and Collins and Loeffler are going to get in? Because they're spending their time trying to argue about who's the most pro-Trump. One of them would knock each other out, and really it hadn't quite happened, has it?
Well, I'll tell you this. I think the people that sit down with their ballot early and sit in their home and take the time, I think those are going to be more informed voters, and they're going to vote for – you know, on some logic. Either they're going to vote for Raphael Warnock or they're going to vote for one of these other candidates for a reason. And there's a difference there. And I think Raphael Warnock does pretty good with those voters. It's just the quicker voters. And this is if it's close. Now, one thing I think what's going to help to me, him just as much. One, he's been on TV some. I saw his ad today, run at least once during the Falcons football game. But he also was attacked this week by Kelly Loeffler in a campaign ad. And I have to think that somewhere in her polling or somewhere in her strategy, she thinks that for her it would be better to face Raphael Warnock in a one-on-one than facing Doug Collins in a one-on-one runoff. So if she begins to attack him and possibly Collins down the road, although I think he needs to spend his money on Loeffler, but if she starts attacking Raphael Warnock, she's going to lift him up to where he then makes the runoff. As strange as that sounds, you usually don't get attacked. What do you think about that theory, Catherine?
That's an interesting theory. I think she's if her advisors are telling her that, I think that's true. I think she has a better chance of winning against Warnock than against Collins in a runoff.
Yeah, and it was real interesting because earlier in the year, Doug Collins offered to do a series of debates with Raphael Warnock, kind of circumventing Kelly Loeffler. It's kind of like they're using Raphael Warnock in a way to you know, hey, we'll elevate him, cutting the other one out of the deal, which in this phase of the game is good for him because he's got to get to that next phase. Whatever that may look like, and as a Georgia Democrat for many, many of these runoffs, I don't relish a runoff with nothing on the ballot, but sometimes you just got to be in the game to play just to see what happens.
Right.
Yeah. Well, I want to thank J.J. Ames for coming on the show, and next week we're going to have a frequent guest of the Kudzu Vine on. Robin Biro will be our guest.
Oh, great.
Yeah. Until next week, it's been the Kudzu Vine.
Good night,
guys.